In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's coolest conversations time in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be chatting shortly with Glenn Page, the guitarist and lead vocalist in the Len Price 3. The band is from Medway in the UK. That's the area in southeast England around Kent, which has been fertile ground for garage-styled rock and roll bands since the 1990s. The group's newest album is Misty Medway Magic. It's out on Wicked Cool Records. And it sports our recent coolest song in the world, Misty Medway. Let's give that a listen, and afterwards I'll be back with Glenn for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
When I'm at sixes, sevens, and nines, when my heart's pacing out of time, take me down to the misty Medway, lay me down on a muddy bank, take me down to the misty Medway, where I can let my mind go. Take me down to the misty Midway. Lay me down on the ground right next to you, like I do.
It's time for our coolest conversations in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and this is the Mighty Manfred with you. My guest, Glenn Page. He's a guitarist and lead vocalist in the Len Price 3. They're from Medway in the UK. Their new album, Misty Medway Magic, is out on Wicked Cool Records, and it features this week's coolest song in the world, Misty Medway. How are you, Glenn?
I'm very well, Manfred. It's good to be here.
Well, good to speak with you again, my friend. Our coolest song, as I mentioned, Misty Medway, the album Misty Medway Magic. For those who are not familiar with Medway in the UK, where and what is it?
Yeah, the Medway is a river, but it's also the name of an area which is in the southeast corner of Kent, Kent being the garden of England. And for some people in the northern part of the country, they deem it basically part of France. It's not really. But Medway is an old, kind of rusty, post-industrial place with a muddy river that runs through it.
And I read that there are about 280,000 people in the region, but it sports this incredible music scene. We've got, you know, if we want to go on a timeline, here's the, roughly the kinds of things that interest us. The Milkshakes with Mickey Hampshire and Billy Childish, and, of course, their later groups and spinoffs, and The Prisoners with Graham Day and his later bands, and other contemporary groups like the Galileo 7, Groovy Uncle. What accounts for, you mentioned Medway as a river. Is there something in the water? What's the result of this music scene, the vibrant music scene? It's been going on for a while.
Yeah, it's hard to explain, really. People often ask me this. I think it's funny to think of it as a scene, because it's actually quite a small group of people that have been making music over quite a long period of time, if you know what I mean. So people like Billy Childish and Graham Day have been kicking around for quite a long time, and a lot of the bands have either made up of people that were either in bands with some of those big luminaries, like you mentioned the Galileo 7, so that's Alan from The Prisoners. You talked about Groovy Uncle, the singer from that band, Glenn Pragnell, was in a band with Alan and Wolf and a few other, you know, sort of Medway muso types. So it's quite a kind of interconnected scene. I think for me the thing that sort of binds it all together is it's quite a rough place. And what I mean by that is, if you start out doing music in somewhere like Medway, certainly if you go back sort of 30 years, as some of us have done, it was quite, you know, people would be very honest. So if you were rubbish, they would tell you and they'd throw things at you. And I've certainly played gigs where there's been kind of, you know, brawls kicking off in the pub, you know, while you're doing a show. So you sort of have to be quite sharp, quite focused, energy driven. And I think there's something about the honesty as well, you know, like doing music that you genuinely like and feel, and it kind of comes from the heart rather than being some kind of glossy showbiz thing or a drive at being famous. You know, it drives honesty, I think. It drives a lot of honesty and grit.
So honesty and grit, but there also seems with these bands that I mentioned and yourselves as well, there's an affinity or fondness for 60s artists, The Who, The Kinks, U.S. garage rock bands from the 60s. What accounts for that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, maybe because we're all kind of, stuck in the past. That could be part of it. But I think there's also, again, back to that kind of honesty and grit thing. I think there's something about driving for a sound that is, you know, honest, heartfelt. And I think that, you know, the music of the, I mean, you could talk about the 60s, and that's certainly one of the, you know, the bigger drivers, but you could talk about, you know, some of the, you know, the great punk bands from the 70s, where that's the, you know, the Pistols, the Clash, the Undertones, the Ramones, people like that. You know, what have they got in common? There is something about the sound that's quite raw. And again, for me, that echoes that kind of honesty. You know, as opposed to a lot of, you know, like myself. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, you know, hearing, you know, bands like, I don't know, Genesis, or, you know, those kind of hair metal bands where the sound was anything but that. You know, it's big, you know, big overproduced music. And so I think there's something about the scene that is about honesty and grit, and that comes through in the sound as well as the kind of overall approach and lyrics and songwriting and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm thinking, correct me if I'm wrong, Misty Medway Magic, this is your 7th full-length album?
I think so, Manfred. I'm not very good at maths, but that's about right.
That's what I'm counting. So your first is 2005's Chinese Burn. Can you remind us, like, when you guys formed?
Yeah, I mean, we did our first gig a very long time ago. It was 2001. That was our first ever gig. And then we probably should have given up after that because it was a horrible gig. Everything went wrong. We forgot the songs. It was
how many songs did you play, by the way, your first gig?
In the first gig, I would imagine there was probably about 15, something like 12.
Oh, wow, 15, so a lot.
Ballpark. It was an awful gig. In fact, the best thing about it was that there was a gentleman that performed an excellent trick, pulling a condom over his head and over his nose, and then inflating it using his nostrils. That was the highlight for many people. Which probably gives you an indication of how great the music was. So we went away, licked our wounds after that, gave it some thought as to whether we wanted to do any more shows. And we didn't play again for months after that. But then it was sort of 2005 before we got a kind of, you know, record out, which was the first album. So, you know, we kicked around for a couple of years before we actually...
So when you guys did that first gig, that was with... both Neil on the drums and Steve on the bass.
The same lineup, yeah, exactly.
Same
yeah.
lineup, okay. Yeah. And how did you meet those guys?
So I knew Neil already. Neil and I met in the mid-90s. So I was in a band in the mid-90s called the Wogans. We had a drummer called the Gibbon who couldn't really drum. And we played at this club one night, and the promoter said, "Your drum's awful. You should meet Neil, the guy that does the sound here. He's a really good drummer." So Neil came down to one of our rehearsals and played. And he was in after about three beats. And then we just, you know, remained in touch, remained friends. And then after that band broke up, there was a little kind of hiatus, and I started writing songs in again. And I said to Neil, asked him if he'd help me record them. And then so he did. And then he helped. I said, "Well, should we do some shows? Maybe just kind of see how it goes, do two or three shows." And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "I know this bass player, Steve," because they were in another band together at the time called Dr. Gonzo. And Steve came into the fold from there, and that's how we got together.
Wow. All right. So, and you've had a couple of albums on Wicked Cool, and then the two more recent full lengths aren't, but now you're back with the label. What brought you back to Wicked Cool Records?
Yeah, so we came out on a brief US tour in 2023 to the East Coast, and we could call we've been working with them up until that point anyway, because we re-released the first album Chinese Burn on vinyl, so we'd had that kind of contact, and then they very kindly offered to do a single to tie in with the American tour, which was great. And then they said, you know, how about doing another album? So we said, yeah, okay, why not? Let's go. And that's how it happened.
Well, my liner notes say that the new long player produced by Jim Riley and Stevie Van Zandt. Now, is that right? Both those guys had a hand in producing?
Yes.
Okay, well, specifically, first I want to ask about Jim, because he's got a studio that's there in the area, right? What's this place?
It's called Ranscombe Studios.
Okay, and what can you tell me about Jim? Like, how did you meet him? When did you start working with him?
Yeah, so Jim's a guy that's been kicking around as part of that Medway scene for a long time, since the late 70s, I think. He's a fantastic musician in his own right, particularly playing the harp and the guitar. And he's at this studio, I think he started in the early 2000s, probably about 2002, 2003, that sort of time. And, you know, Graham Day, so the Jailers, Jamie Taylor for erstwhile of the Prisoners, Billy Childish records all this stuff there. You know, like everybody on the scene kind of uses Jim's studio. And Jim's a really great guy to work with because he's got an amazing ear. He's very adaptable at kind of working with different people and different musical styles. But I think his biggest asset is he's really good at just kind of putting you at ease and making you feel really kind of comfortable with what you're doing and kind of trying stuff out. So he's quite a remarkable guy. And it was actually when we did our first record there, well, before we actually got to do the first record, we went in to just try this studio out and do a studio out and try a couple of songs in about 2003. And when we kind of played it back, we had a real kind of that's it kind of moment, saying that this is the sound we want. This is what we've been after, you know, since we started. So he really has been a kind of an instrumental player in kind of, you know, making us as a band and kind of helping develop our sound. So that ended up becoming the first album, you know, but way back in 2004, 2005.
Right. And so I was going to ask, so the new long player, well, when did you record this one?
So we recorded this one, I think it was the middle of last year.
All right. And the material on there, the songs, is it mostly new material, or were these a number of songs that were from, you know, that you have been waiting to put on an album for a while, or what's the story with the 13?
Yeah, they were written within a year of kind of recording them, you know, so I had a splurge of writing songs, you know, so if, losing track of the years now. So if we were recording it in summer 2024, that's right. And then going back the year, so yeah, 23, I probably was writing songs all the way through there. And then that was about 12 months worth of work. And then we put it all to disc.
Well, let me ask you specifically about the song. So you're the principal songwriter. And what is the process? I mean, are you going as far as making, putting together demos with parts on them, or are you guys getting together in a rehearsal space and you're kind of showing them the outline of the song, or what, how do you guys work up?
How do we work it? Yeah. I kind of come up with the, you know, I'll normally have like a verse and a chorus and maybe a, you know, middle eight or something. And I don't normally write all of the lyrics before showing the you know, the song to the band, not normally, you know, sometimes I do. But normally it's, you know, I've got these parts, verse, chorus, and, you know, maybe some other riff or something. And then we get together as a band and work out what the structure should be. Neil's really great at sort of vocal harmonies and arrangements and stuff. So, you know, he sort of helps with that side of things. And then it depends who we're working with as to what happens next. So working with Wicked Cool, they like us to kind of demo up the songs first of all. So we just do like a rough recording as a band, share that with with the label before kind of going into the studio proper for, you know, a bit of a conversation there. If we're doing it ourselves, then we'll literally just record it on our phones or something live at practice, just so we've got, you know, sort of something to work with, and then go straight into the studio. But yeah, I kind of write them, you know, come up with the ideas, we hammer them into shape as a band, and then usually the last thing is me kind of, you know, fine-tuning the lyrics, finishing the lyrics, and then I don't normally do that until we're just on the cusp of recording them, you know, going into the studio.
Okay, so we spoke some about Jim, and so he's also acting his role as he's actually engineering as well as producing.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so what was Stephen's role as producer?
Yeah, so on this one, we demoed them up. We got the go-ahead from the guys at Wicked Cool, recorded it in the studio, shared the sort of provisional mixes with Wicked Cool, and then Stephen came back with some sort of suggestions about trying some stuff out with some of the songs.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like a bit of a sort of trial and error process. So what we then do is we'll go and try those things out, and while we're about it, we might end up going, oh, and while we're here, let's try this as well. So for example, there's a song on the last song on the record called One Day You Will Break My Heart, and he suggested putting a harpsichord on it, because I think when we originally did it, it was really, really bare. So it's just a vocal track, guitar and bass, I think, really kind of slow, moody number. So he suggested putting harpsichord and drums on, actually. So that was sorted out. And then while we were kind of playing around with it, we were getting these kind of 60s film soundtrack vibes. So we tried putting an instrument called a cymbal on the track as well, and that's made it. So it's, you know, it's a sort of funny kind of process of bouncing ideas around. So Stephen will come in with some stuff, we'll try it out. Usually it works. He's got a good ear for this kind of stuff, and then maybe we'll kind of chuck some other stuff in as well.
Okay, this week's coolest song in the world, Misty Medway, off the new album. Is this this is the ode to your cherished home? I mean, lay me down on the muddy banks. Really? You want to be laid down on the muddy banks? Tell me, I mean, are you actually from Medway?
Yeah, I sort of thought you might ask me this question.
Yes, Andrew, well, yeah, you're right.
I've been sort of scratching my head, really. It's a little while ago. These are the things I remember, right? So there's one thing. I remember driving to work one day, and there's a tunnel that takes you through underneath the Medway and across the other side. And I used to drive that route every day to go to work. And yeah, one day I was driving towards the tunnel, and I looked over to the river, and it was like a cold, crisp kind of February morning. And there was this sort of beautiful scene that I'd never seen before, where the sun was just coming up, sunrise, and there was this kind of cotton wool kind of fluffy mist just sitting, you know, just above the river, and it and there was this like lovely kind of grassy muddy bank, and I was thinking, that looks like a beautiful place. I'd like to, and I must have driven past this a million times, you know, not really noticed it, but it just really caught my eye. So that was the thing that made me think I might write a song about this. But in terms of then what is it kind of about, I suppose there's a lot of stuff on this record, right? A lot of songs I was writing at quite a difficult time. So my mother died sort of around the time I was writing the songs for this. So naturally with that, there's a certain kind of melancholy. There's a certain kind of reflection on, you know, mortality and all the rest of it that kind of, you know, creeps in, I guess, even if you're not really kind of overtly thinking about it. So I think this song is partially a celebration of, you know, where I'm from. And I spent quite a lot of time as a young man, I guess, being slightly embarrassed of where I was from for all sorts of kind of cultural reasons. But now actually I've learned never to be embarrassed or ashamed of where you're from. In fact, to wear it, you know, front and center on your chest as well as on your sleeve. I was also thinking about, some of it's actually really quite beautiful and quite, you know, lovely and uplifting. And you know what? I wouldn't mind having my ashes scattered on the banks of the River Medway. So it was that. But it was also about, you know, thinking about a place where, you know, going to places when you need a little bit of a lifting up and a little bit of kind of happiness and peace. And you know, I've certainly found that on the banks of the river over the years. So it's all of those things.
And you mentioned earlier, Neil, providing really cool backing vocal parts, and that's something I believe he does on this throughout the album, really. Is he also playing that short organ bit there on Misty Medway? Yeah.
So Neil's one of those guys who can, you know, pick up basically any musical instrument and just, you know, get something out of it. Lucky so-and-so. He plays the keyboard parts, yeah, as well as doing the backing vocals and playing the drums.
And whose idea to do the hand claps?
I can't remember. I think that was just, you know, we were probably just together in the, you know, in the studio going, hey, should we try this out? I mean, with that song in particular, I was kind of thinking, and I remember when I was sitting down to sort of try and write it, I was kind of going for something like, you know, it could have been on the Kinks Village Green Preservation Society album, right? That was what I was kind of channeling there. And I suppose there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of little bits like those kind of darkly quiet kind of organ parts and you know, sort of nice, you know, percussion type parts in that. So, yeah, maybe we were kind of talking about those things.
I know as a songwriter, you seem to have an affinity for tunes that use a call out or have a specific name in them. So on this album, there's Emily Schaub, Arthur's Whirlwind, Hee Haw's Daughter. On other albums, you got songs, you know, Mr. Gray, The Great Omani, Shirley Crabtree, Julia Jones, Billy Mason, My Granddad Jim, who I believe was your granddad, Lisa Baker. And I know, like, The Great Omani, was a real person. Your granddad Jim was real. But are most of these names, are they characters you invented?
It's a mixture. A lot of them are real. I think if I didn't do music, I'd probably be a teller of stories, you know, either a writer or a historian or something. And I've always been particularly interested in, you know, ordinary people that do extraordinary things, if you know what I mean. So, you know, about finding the extraordinary or the wonderful or the amazing, or indeed the very, you know, sort of the very dark in just everyday life, right? So I guess that fascination kind of comes out in the music, and that's why I write these songs that are about kind of characters. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned kind of Emily Schaub, because the Emily of, you know, the Emily in that story is actually a character from a television show, a 1970s children's TV show called Bagpuss, which I used to watch avidly as a small child. And it's left quite a mark in my consciousness, you know, sort of something I've shared with my own children and everything. So, you know, that would be an example of, you know, just a name in a slightly different context. But like you said, The Great Omani, that was a real kind of character. I saw a brief documentary program about him on TV a long time ago, you know, about 15 years ago plus. Just this remarkable guy, you know, a sort of, you know, 90-year-old escape artist applying his trade in Brighton. And then Hor Hor's Daughter is about a guy who decided to support the British Union of Fascists in the 1930s, then moved to Germany, where he became a kind of mouthpiece for German propaganda in the Second World War. But his daughter lived in Medway, and I had no idea until recently, and I just thought that was an absolutely fascinating thing, you know, to kind of have, and what would that be like to kind of have that in your family? How would you sort of process that? What must that experience be like? You know, she was a head teacher of a school, you know, and quite a prominent local figure. But yeah, you're just like everyday life and the kind of strange things that go on behind kind of closed doors. That's something that's always fascinated me, I guess. So I rambled a bit there, Manfred.
That's quite all right, because the question I wanted to ask was, you know, and I think you were addressing this, was you, are you a frustrated novelist in a sense? But the way you had sort of answered this was by mentioning that you know, you like to tell stories, and perhaps if you hadn't been doing music, that's you would have channeled that into. So what exactly got you channeled in into music as opposed to writing?
Yeah, so I guess I've told this story a few times over the years, but the music was always in my house, in my kind of consciousness as a child. So, I remember my mum and dad's record collection featuring the Beatles, the Stones, and a lot of those kind of classic 50s rock and rollers like Little Richard and Gene Vincent, people like that. So that was always kind of there. And then, as I sort of mentioned earlier, you know, I'm sort of child of child of the 80s, really. And at that time, obviously, it's the pre-internet age. So what's being fed into my kind of into my ears? Well, you know, it's the music of the 1980s, you know. And then at some point, I reckon I was about 13 or 14. There were two things that kind of happened, really, I would say, that sort of set me down this path. So one was I'd been talking to a friend at school about the music of Chuck Berry, which at that point, strangely, I hadn't really heard much of. And this guy gave me this cassette of three Chuck Berry songs that he recorded from his dad's record collection. I think they were 78. So they were really kind of grainy, scratchy recordings. And there was Johnny B. Goode, Roll Over Beethoven, and Run Rudolph Run. And he gave me this tape, and I took it home, and all I had was this little kind of boxy kind of cassette player to play these things on. And I remember pressing play, and then the kind of crackle and the hiss kind of coming in. And it was like, it was then like something kind of beaming in from another universe. You know, the opening riff of Johnny B. Goode started up. And it was electrifying, you know, it was like literally being struck by lightning. Everything was kind of tingling, everything just seemed, you know, I just seemed much more alive somehow. And I kind of thought, this is it, this is the thing, you know. It was like my kind of, you know, my soul was on fire, you might say. So that was a real moment. And then there was another time, I want to say shortly after this, where I was off school sick with similar age, about 14, I was off school sick with the flu or something. And then I decided to revisit, my mum and dad's record collection. And, you know, it was the Beatles in particular I remember from this. A little bit of the Stones as well, but mainly the Beatles. And, you know, and rather than just hearing the odd track, you know, as you do as a young child, you're kind of not really playing the music, but it's there. I kind of went through methodically, you know, for each album listening to this. And I was just blown away by the depth of, you know, this kind of incredible sort of songwriting. And again, I was thinking like, I really want to do this. This is like really cool. It's much better than, I don't know, whatever was on the radio at the time, you know, In Excess or something. I was thinking like, this is the stuff. So those were the kind of two moments. And there were other things along the way. I mean, another one I often cite, so I was a bit older then, it was about 1920. I went to see the Head Coats, which is one of Billy Childish's bands, a small venue, about sort of 150, 200 capacity in London, called the Water Rats. And I'd never seen anything like this before, you know, like a kind of, a, you know, no big PA setup, just literally guitars, amps, a single vocal PA, you know, of an old school variety. And it was just the energy and the kind of power that really blew me away. You know, I'd seen sort of, you know, nice bands in pubs doing kind of cover versions of things. And I think I'd been to some gigs like, you know, My Wayward Youth. Yeah, I don't know. I think I saw the Red Hot Chili Peppers and people like that, you know, big venues. But this is the first time I'd seen a band like that that was really gritty and punchy and direct, kind of right in my face. And I thought, like, this is it. That's I want to do that, you know. So it was a bit of a slow burner, I suppose. But those are sort of three experiences I can point to and say maybe this is why I do this, you know.
Well, thinking back to some of the tracks that are on, I wanted to say that when I was listening to Dead Man's Island, got me thinking of, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, I mean, Treasure Island, Tom Sawyer, you know, going out to, don't know if it's out in the Mississippi, but, you know, they're going out to an island in some body of water. Does childhood adventure play into Dead Man's Island at all or not? Or what's the genesis of that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting you should say that, really, Manfred, because, I mean, there's no sort of direct childhood adventure element in that song. I'll talk about what that song's about in just a minute. But I suppose I do think about kind of childhood experiences quite a lot. You know, I mean, you mentioned the song My Granddad Jim earlier, and that, you know, when I was a child, my granddad was my hero, you know, and all the kind of war stories and everything and where he'd been and all his travels. You know, that was a really, you know, a strong, impactful experience. It's something, you know, I still think about now, you know. I suppose the fact that I'm writing about Emily Shop and kind of Bagpuss and stuff, you know, those kind of childhood memories are still kind of seeping out, creeping out in a variety of ways. But the Dead Man's Island, this song on Misty Medway Magic, it's actually about an island in the, it's not actually in the Medway, it's in the Thames estuary, which is the kind of, you know, the neighbouring river. And it's an island where there used to be kind of prison hulks moored. So these are ships, you know, if you go back to the days of the early 1800s, early mid 1800s. So after the big wars with France, you know, Napoleon and all that, there were lots of prisoners and they were kept in these ships called prison hulks out in the river estuary. And, you know, that was a dark time. And when there were outbreaks of things like, you know, disease, various diseases, what they would do is they row them out onto this island, which has been called Dead Man's Island. They bury them there. And over the years, the mud has kind of eroded. So you can go to this island and there's sort of bones sticking out of the ground all over the place. So it's quite a, you know, quite a Robert Louis Stevenson-esque, I guess. You could imagine that kind of being a thing in a, you know, in one of his books. Yeah.
It's also a Dickens, I can't think of what the Dickens novel is, but, you know, it takes place with the
Expectations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The guys escaping from there, taken back to there.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dickens actually lived in Medway for a significant part of his time. And a lot of those books, including Great Expectations, are set in the kind of Medway area. So there's, you know, the marshland that he talks about and the prison hulks, that's, you know, that's in Medway, that area.
Well, you already mentioned the album's closer, the One Day You'll Break My Heart, and you mentioned, I guess, Stephen suggesting a harpsichord part in there. I thought like I was hearing like a glockenspiel in there.
Oh yeah, glockenspiel, that's right. Yeah, we threw that on as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And so who's playing the glockenspiel?
That's me.
That's you.
Yeah, poorly timed glockenspiel is me. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, great. Very cool. Very cool. So you had, I was looking up through the Book of Faces there. You had an album release show recently. Where was that at?
Yeah, that was a venue called the Lexington in London.
Yeah, Lexington. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great venue, the Lexington. Really, really good sound, good people running it. Nice setup, you know, easy to see the stage wherever you are. So, we love playing there. It's a really, really good place.
Well, I saw a comment, something, you're thanking this guy Tom for the additional six-string power. So who's Tom and what songs required additional power?
So Tom is my son.
How old is your son?
He's going to be 20 in December. He's also in a band. So he's a band called Cream Soda. They're on the Spin Out Nuggets label. Their album was out earlier this year. The band, we would have asked them, well, we did ask them to support on the night, but they couldn't make it. The drummer was otherwise engaged. But we got Tom up to play guitar on two or three songs just for a giggle. And he also did the prize draw, dressed up as a big red triangle, but that's a whole other story.
Well, what several songs did he play with you at the show? Did he play on any of the songs that are on the new album?
No, he played an old one. So we still do a cover version of Comanche, the Link Wray song. In fact,
great.
That's the only song that survived from our first ever gig. You know, the one that was a disaster. So we played that pretty much, not every gig, but pretty close to every gig. We played Comanche by Link Wray. So he came out and played on that one. and then a song called London Institute, which is on our Nobody Knows album, and then another one off the first record, which is Chinese Burn, the eponymous track.
Well, if I'm remembering correctly, is this, if I may not have this right, but it seems like you guys came over to play in New York City one time, and then you had Graham Day playing with you. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That was back in about 2008, something like that.
And now, so has he actually produced you guys before, or what's your relationship with Graham?
Well, so our relationship is kind of mates. You know, we're friends, really.
Yeah.
My first recollection of meeting Graham was, it must have been about 2007, 2006, seven, something like that. We used to do this regular gig at a venue in Chatham called the Command House, which was a great venue, really small. And so you'd have kind of, there's no in-house PA, so you'd have your own vocal PA and you'd have your amps and your kit set up, and you'd be just literally face-to-face with the crowd like this, you know, mic here and people, right, you know, really tight. But it was a brilliant gig to do. And, I got chatting to Graham. He'd come down to one of the shows, and it was really sweet, actually, because I knew, you know, he's a legend, you know, Graham, you know, the Prisoners and everything. And he said at the time that we'd inspired him to start up another band after, you know, he'd taken a bit of a break from music. And it was the Jailers, you know, with your good buddies. That was a real kind of touching moment. So we kind of carried on, you know, keeping in touch. We did a show with him out in New York. We played some shows with the Jailers, kept in touch, and then when it came to the Pictures album, we asked him to come and produce it. So he came along and did the stuff in the studio. He kind of helped with that. He sort of co-produced the record with us for Pictures.
And so let's think about, we mentioned this record release gig that you had recently. Do you have any other shows upcoming?
Yeah, we got a few things. There's a couple of dates in the UK. So we're playing in Stockton, which is in the northeast, and in Birmingham in the Midlands this side of Christmas. And then in the new year, we've got a tour in Spain at the end of January, playing about five dates there. And then we're coming back out. We haven't officially announced this yet, but I guess I am doing so now. we're coming out to the US in March, so that'll be March 19th in New Hampshire, 20th in Bedford, the sort of Boston area, 21st in New York City, and then the 22nd in New Jersey. So we'll be announcing that on our socials in the next few weeks.
Well, fantastic. So you're getting a toehold up there in the Northeast U.S. Have you ever been to the West Coast?
We haven't, but if anybody's listening and can offer us some gigs out that way, we'd love to make the trip.
All right. We're going to have to pass that along. Well, okay, so the tune I'd like us to go out on, it's off the new album, and the song is Strange Love. So what is the strangest love you've ever had?
I'm not sure I can disclose that on air, Manfred.
Well, let's say if someone else had inspired the song, what was the strangest love they had had?
I don't know. No, I can tell you what the song is actually about. So I mentioned that I went through a bit of a difficult time when I was writing these songs, right? So I was thinking about my mum. So I had a kind of, you know, I love my mum, and I was really sad when she died. But it was a complex relationship, difficult to explain, I suppose, not in a kind of weird or creepy way, but just we were kind of very different people. I suppose at the time I was just thinking about, you know, what does it all mean, and those kind of, you know, questions. I never really resolved it, you know, Yeah, I suppose it's just about trying to work out, what, you know, when we love people, what does that mean? And, you know, I suppose you can love people in different ways, can't you? And sometimes it's about trying to fathom out what it all, you know, what is this thing? And I suppose at that time when I was writing that song, it was just me trying to make sense of you know, that relationship and love for my mum.
Glenn, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me, chatting with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Manfred. Thanks for having me on. Always good to chat with you.
We're going to give a listen to Strange Love off the new album Misty Medway Magic. It's the Len Price 3 and Little Stevens Underground Garage. Strange Love. That's the Len Price 3 off their new Wicked Cool Records album, Misty Medway Magic, here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Glenn Page for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. The Stray Cats, they're a longtime favorite of ours here in the Underground Garage. The band has had quite a journey this year, releasing a new single, but at the same time, guitar player Brian Setzer has been suffering from an autoimmune disease. Their drummer Slim Jim Phantom, he's a DJ here in the Underground Garage, hosting his Rockabilly Rave Up every Sunday night. And Jim is going to join me next time around to tell us all about their new release and also give us an update on Brian's condition. That's your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.